This is our first JEP event that we're having in the home.
So it's a real pleasure to be here. Richard and Lori are very active members of this community. Rabbi Fink, who is the Rav of the Young Israel of New Rochelle, we're very honored to have you with us, Rabbi. He can attest to the fact that Richard and Lori play a major role in his very vibrant synagogue in terms of making things happen. And we're honored and delighted and privileged to be here at your home this evening. We hope that our being here tonight will create a wellspring of bracha for you and for your entire family. Our lecture tonight is a memorial lecture in memory of Jack Ginsburg. Clive is the son of his father of blessed memory, and he arranged that we would have an annual lecture in memory of his father, and certainly learning Torah, as we hope to do right here this evening, is something that really elevates a departed soul in the world of eternity, and we hope that this will happen and benefit your father's neshama very greatly in the world of eternity in Olam Haba, where he resides at present. Yaakov ben Ephraim Noach. It is my pleasure to say that we have tonight, we're celebrating a bar mitzvah. Now, nobody here knew that they were being invited to a bar mitzvah. But we are celebrating a bar mitzvah. This is the 13th consecutive year that we are going to be privileged to hear Rabbi Mordechai Becher, our speaker this evening. And we haven't had anybody speak, I would say, even half as many times. The fact that Rabbi Becher, I mean, if you haven't heard Rabbi Becher previously, by the time you leave this evening, you'll understand why we're having this bar mitzvah, why we've had him back so many times each and every year. Rabbi Becher is an individual who is I would call him a special gift from the Almighty to the Jewish people. He is, I can only tell you that if you would have a travel brochure of all of the locations in the world where Rabbi Becher has spoken, it would be quite a pile of travel brochures. He's been everywhere, and for very good reason. I've been privileged to attend seminars of the organization where Rabbi Becher is a senior lecturer, Gateways. I would see how, you know, you could have a packed hotel for an entire weekend with 500-600 people, and Rabbi Becher, I witnessed how he would electrify the crowd, and including myself. So he's been doing this all over the world, and he does this on a regular basis, not only at Gateways, but he's also involved as a Torah instructor in Yeshiva University, and for young students who are growing and seeking their pathway in life and could use a little bit of, a jump start. Rabbi Becher is there to provide it, and without further ado, it is my great privilege and our collective honor to present Rabbi Becher, a very dear personal friend of mine.
So, thank you for the introduction. That was really quite a reminder of Yechezkel Abramsky, who was a famous rabbi in England, later on in Israel. There was a move to ban shchita in England, kosher slaughter, and he submitted a brief to the court in defense of shchita, and he was being interviewed by the judge, and the judge said, Rabbi Abramsky, you've written here in your deposition that you are the most respected rabbi in all of England. Is this correct? Rabbi Abramsky says, yes, that is correct. He says, you've also written that you are the most eloquent spokesman for Judaism in the entire British Empire. Is that correct as well? Rabbi Abramsky says, also true, Your Honor. He says, you've also written in your own deposition, Rabbi Abramsky, that you are the most respected Jewish legal authority in England. Is that also correct? Rabbi Abramsky said, yes, that's also true. So the judge says, off the record, Rabbi Abramsky, but how does your deposition fit with the biblical concept of humility? Rabbi Abramsky said, it's a problem, Your Honor, but I'm under oath. history, the Aruch HaShulchan, very famous halachic work, writes that it's actually correct and appropriate to study history, Jewish history. And he says, he quotes the smug Sefer Mitzvot Gadol, Rav Moshe of Kutzi in France, who says that it's really it's almost of a mitzvah. It's not one of the 613 commandments, but it's an important thing to do. And the reason is that from it we can learn about divine providence. But I think there's more to it than that. History can sometimes be Torah because, especially Jewish history, there's a book of the Torah, the seven books of Moses. You're familiar with the seven books of Moses, right? Was it five? No. So the Talmud actually says there's a statement in the Talmud that there's seven, because the book of Bamidbar is actually divided into three sections. There's Bamidbar up until Vayehi bin Soa Ha'aron. Everyone's familiar with that, right? And it was when the ark traveled, not Noah's ark, but the ark with the Torah in it, right? The Raiders of the Lost Ark. And so it was when the ark traveled, right? And that sentence, those two sentences, considered to be an entire book of the Torah in and of itself. Everyone heard of that? Anyone heard of that idea? It's like really weird. It's like, Vayehi bin Soa, and it was when the ark traveled. Vayomer Moshe, God said, arise, God. And Moses said, arise, O God, and spread out your enemies, scatter your enemies. Shuva Yisrael, uvenucho yomar, shuva Hashem rivo tofe Yisrael. And when it rested, so the thousands of Jews rest. It's very strange. That's considered to be like a book of the Torah. It's a book of the Torah. So there was a great rabbi, Reb Chaim Yosef David Azulai, who asked the Chidah. So he asked, how can it be that two sentences is like an entire book of the Torah? Granted, certainly a rabbi could extend those two sentences a lot, right? I forgot who said it, but he said a speech, he said, is a 2-minute thought diluted by a 2-hour vocabulary. But the Torah has a lot in it, but how do you see an entire book of the Torah in those two sentences? So the Chidah says the following. He says those two sentences are really descriptions of the Jewish people going through history. Jewish people's travel is Vayehi bin Soa Ha'aron, the ark that carried the Torah, i.e. the Jewish people. We travel through history. And he says, in the future, in the Messianic age, we'll be able to look into those two psukim verses and unfold dimensions of them and be able to see all of Jewish history. Because in the same way that the Torah, the events of the Jewish people described in the Torah have become Torah, because the Torah describes them, so everything that happens to the Jewish people throughout history will eventually become Torah. Because it's us who are the bearers, the carriers of Torah throughout history, and consequently, what has happened to the Jewish people, what will happen to the Jewish people, what does happen to the Jewish people, is, in a sense, Torah. In the same way that everything that happened to Abraham, his entire life was Torah, so also for the Jewish people as a whole. So that's why it's, I think, important to look at these ideas. We're going to talk about some weird and wonderful aspects of Jewish history, but I want to take a particular methodology. If you're examining, let's say, particles and how particles behave, and you are familiar with various forces that act on the particles, and we know of the gravitation, right, gravity and electromagnetic force and the weak nuclear force and the strong nuclear force and so on and so forth, right? So you'd look at a particle, and the way the particle behaves is not explained with those four forces. It doesn't make sense. It seems to act in a way that is not in accordance with those four. What would you have to posit? You might posit there may be a fifth. Maybe there's another force acting on this particle. It's a unique particle. Sometimes
there's been discoveries of planets which are not necessarily visible. But the discovery of those planets is based on the behavior of the electromagnetic radiation from stars in proximity to those planets. And because an object of great mass will affect the space-time in that area, so therefore the electromagnetic radiation will be curved or will be affected by the object of great mass. So you can actually infer that there's an object of great mass, a planet, near that star by observing the light or the EM radiation from that star. Am I making sense here?
Yeah.
Okay. So when we look at the Jewish people, I think we have to use the same type of analysis. Okay? The Jewish people are evidence of of another force. And so I imagine if you imagine you're an alien, which I find very easy to imagine for myself, which is a little disturbing. But if I was, let's say, an alien and I had to examine human history, you know, alien, let's say, lives for half a million years, so you've got a project over the summer from high school, right, which is a 6,000 years in our year project, right? So, and you're observing Earth, you know, flying saucer, and you're observing all these various civilizations. So I believe that this alien will probably, you know, an alien actually landed in Arkansas, and he comes out of his UFO, and he's covered with eyes and tentacles, and he seems to be like glistening with a silicon type look, and someone asks him, "Do all the creatures in your planet look like you?" He says, "Yeah, they all have tentacles all over the place. Yeah, yeah. They have eyes all over them. Yeah, yeah. And they're all silicon based creatures." And he says, "Yes, they all have that round black thing on their head." He says, "No, not the goyim." So anyway, this alien is observing history, and he's looking at various nations. I believe that the alien will notice a number of very unique features about the Jewish people. Now, some of these features are shared, they're not completely unique, because some are shared by other nations, but all of those features together, I think he will see that only Jewish history seems to exhibit some of these properties. First of all, survival. Now, okay, survival, but I don't mean genetic survival, because everyone's genes have survived. You know what I mean? No, I'm sure there are Etruscan genes around and Visigoths all over the place. I think I saw one in Manhattan recently. But there are, all genes have survived, but with the Jewish people, there's a cultural survival, which is a fairly unique in many areas. First of all, language. So Hebrew, which, by the way, is a language that was not used outside of prayer and study for thousands of years. It is, as far as I know, the only language to have been resurrected, right? Revived in a way which is unbelievable. I mean, the state of Israel, it's the language now of a state of 8 million people. It's a language in which scientific papers are written. It's a language in which an army is run, a government is run. Well, the government doesn't really run, but it's a language. It's amazing. It's an amazing thing. Novels translated into Hebrew. It's incredible that a language has risen from the dead. But what's interesting about it is, you could take an Israeli child. So one of my sons, we were at the Israel Museum when he was a kid, grew up in Israel. He's back there now. So we were at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem. And there's the Dead Sea Scroll exhibit. And there's a scroll, the scroll of Isaiah, Yeshayahu, was on display. And that was the Dead Sea Scrolls written around 2000, 2100 years ago or so. And Isaiah goes back a few hundred years, even well before then, 500 years before then. So my kid looks at the display and he starts reading. Chazon Yeshua ben Amoz, Chazon Yerov Yishleim. He says, "Abba, Abba, come here." And I come over there. And he says, "We were doing this in school last week." I said to myself, it's a miracle. He remembered what he's doing in school last week. Shocking. But what was actually even more miraculous was the fact that here is a child of the 21st century, then it was the 20th, a child of the 20th century reading something written over 2,500 years ago, no problem understanding it. No problem understanding it. And not only did he understand the language and speak the language, but the cultural things that were referred to. You know, if you look in the Vim and it says, and it talks about Oneg Shabbat, talks about the pleasure of Shabbat. He knows what that's talking about. You look at an artifact. So Biblical Archaeology Review, in every edition, they have a little picture of an artifact. And it says, what is this artifact? A, B, or C? And then you know, you have to turn to page 63 for the answer. Okay, and it's very difficult to identify the artifact. Is this a comb? Is it a Phoenician torture device? What is this? You have no idea. But in the Dead Sea Scroll exhibit, there's a set of tefillin from Qumran, from 2,000 years ago. And guess what? You can identify them as tefillin. They're square, they're leather boxes, they have the same parchments we have, they're not black anymore, granted 2,000 years. But you can identify them. So language, artifacts, the cultural artifacts, for example, we have mikvahs. I think I maybe did a presentation here about mikvah, but we have mikvahs. I was in Sicily in summer. We're in a place called Syracusa. And in Syracusa, there's five mikvahs in a basement of a palazzo, of a palace, was a palace. There were five mikvahs fed by an underground river, which are over 1,000 years old. And there are mikvahs in Masada, which are actually over approximately 2,000 years old. Those mikvahs are instantly recognizable as mikvahs. When Yigal Yadin found them, and it was all over the newspapers in Israel, that oldest mikveh found. So rabbis from Yerushalayim, one of them was Rav Mintzberg, came to Masada to check the mikvehs to see if they were kosher. Yigal Yadin writes about this in his book Masada, in which he was fascinated to see, because the rabbis were evaluating the mikveh based on the 16th century code of Jewish law. And yet the mikveh was built over 2,000 years ago, and hundreds of years before the actual laws of mikveh in the Mishnah were even written down. And the rabbis came and they said this, shufra, the word, I think if I remember correctly, he quotes one of the rabbis, who the rabbi said, shufra de shufra shiva pa'amim. What that means is best of the best seven times over. Or in the language, an American, it would be, it's a sick mikveh. Or dope, it's a dope mikveh, right? But basically, that's an amazing cultural continuity. You understand, to be able to recognize artifacts from 2,000 years ago, which we still use, by the way, to be able to read and converse in the language that was a dead language, except in prayer, for thousands of years. I mean, how many Christians speak Latin? Right? I mean, Catholic Church still uses it in prayer, but it's not a language. So cultural artifacts, religion. Now, contrast that with other nations of great antiquity. For instance, the Greeks. In Greece today, there are Greek Orthodox, which means they're worshipping a Jew called Jesus. Or they're socialists, which means they're worshipping a Jew called Karl Marx. But they are no longer, they're not really inheritors of the Greek theater tradition of Greek philosophy. I mean, there's very few Greek philosophers of recent note. Right. Very few, if any. You could go to South America and you could ask a child to read something written by Aztecs 2,000 years ago. Not going to happen. Right. If you go to Egypt, ask a child to read hieroglyphics. Not going to happen. Go to New Jersey, ask a child to read English. Not going to happen. Right. So therefore, when we talk about the survival, we're not just talking about physical survival, genetic survival, but we're actually talking about the actual culture, which is continued. Oh, and of course, not to forget our land, an attachment to a land which, despite worldwide dispersion, is still there. And it's interesting, the Torah does talk about this, the Torah in Devarim 31, the Torah says that this book, right, even when great and severe troubles overtake them, you will not forget the words of this song. It will not be forgotten. Lo tishakach mipi zaro. It will not be forgotten by your children. That was what the Torah said approximately 3,200 years ago. So the first feature, I think, which is pretty interesting, weird, and wonderful about the Jews is our survival, but a cultural, linguistic, geographical survival. And that is despite a number of factors. First of all, we did not have the benefit of China and India. China and India also have very ancient cultures, but they've had geographic stability. They've been in China and they've been in India. And they've had the advantage, which is an anti-assimilation advantage, of looking different from their neighbours. Jews tended not to look different from the neighbours, and consequently, which would help encourage assimilation. And despite that, the Jews have survived. In addition to which, there are Jewish communities, by the way, which have been in exile for 2,500 years. When the Jews were exiled at the time of the destruction of the first temple, the first Beit HaMikdash, to Babylon, to Iraq, and Iran, Babylon, Persia. So the Jews, the Iraqi Jews, the Iranian Jews are descendants, not all of them, but many of them, are descendants of those original Jews who are literally out of their country, exiled for 2,500 years. We've had anti-Semitism. Now, hatred is not unique to the Jews, although as Woody Allen used to say that his parents sent him to interfaith camp every summer. He says there he was beaten equally by people of all races and creeds. Right. So we don't have a copyright on suffering, but in terms of anti-Semitism, the intensity of it is something which is, in the words of Rabbeinu, one of the Rishonim, he calls it, it's a nais lera'ah. What's nais?
Miracle.
Lera'ah.
Evil.
Yeah. It's miraculous in its bad. In other words, usually we associate miracles with good, but sometimes something is the evil of it, right? The extent of the hatred, the extent of the evil. I mean, just to give you an example, and I don't know if we've discussed this before, but in medieval Europe, and for a long, long time, Christians, many, many Christians, believed that Jews needed Christian blood. Would So, first of all, we need a Christian. Why do we need Christian blood? So that was a late. Yeah, some believe it was for matzah. Others believed it was because Jews had a peculiar stench, which the only cure for it was Christian blood.
The smell of hell.
It could be, yes. But there was a particular stench of the Jewish people. The only way to cure it was Christian blood. There were many Christians who believed that that it was to cure Jewish male menstruation. Could only be cured using Christian blood. It was believed by many Christians that Jews would, what's called torturing the host.
Desecration.
That's, yes, right. But not staying too long at someone's house on Shabbos, that we are guilty of, granted, right? Right, but they would take the wafer from, they would somehow obtain the wafer from the church that was used in the Eucharist. They believed what's called the doctrine of transubstantiation. Meaning that the wafer would become the flesh of Jesus and the wine his blood, and Jews somehow would obtain this wafer and torture it. We would torture a cookie. Literally. Right? People believe this. So there was an irrationality about anti-Semitism, but not only that, I mean, we've been accused of controlling the world at the same time as being accused of being parasites. We've been hated by the left and by the right, simultaneously. Okay, we have been, it's been a universality of it, right? Which is, from socialists and communists to fascists and everything in between, pagans, Christians, Muslims, it's really quite amazing. Right, is in the sense a nais lera'ah. It's something almost supernatural, right? And very often it was to the detriment of the anti-Semite. Often expulsion of the Jews would mean the economy would tank. Not good for the economy. Getting rid of Jewish scientists, either in the case of the communists rejecting certain Jewish science, or in the case of the Nazis getting rid of the Jewish scientists. Many components of that sort, which were really, again, very weird, very, very strange. I mean, there are some strange aspects of that, but sometimes anti-Semites would even be okay. I just read recently about the Jews in Finland, Finnish Jews, fought in the Finnish army during the Second World War against Russia, which, as you probably know, Finland was an ally of the Nazis. So there were Jews fighting on the side of the Nazis in Finland in the Second World War against the Russians. I saw a picture of their army base and their of a unit, and they had an official tent as a synagogue. So here there are Jews who are basically fighting against Russia on the side of the Nazis with a synagogue on base, and they had kosher food supplied should they need it. Bizarre stuff. But anyway, so anti-Semitism is something which is very difficult to say. Now, in addition, we've had a lot of inducements to assimilate. Assimilation has been an option for much of history. Jews could have escaped anti-Semitism. How could we escape anti-Semitism? Not always did it work, but in some cases, conversion to Christianity or to Islam, abandonment of Judaism, assimilation. Heinrich Heine, the great German poet who was born Jewish, was baptized. And he didn't believe in Judaism, didn't believe in Christianity. He says, why am I getting baptized? He writes, because it's a ticket of entry to European culture. And it was. Right? Most universities in Europe for a lot of our history were not open to Jews unless you got baptized first. Okay? So there were some exceptions, Padua, for example, but in general. Right? So we didn't have isolation, meaning we were not in one country for all of our history. We literally were all over the world. I mean, there is a Jewish community in Thailand that dates back to around 1700s. There were already Jews in Thailand in the 18th century. We were discussing the Jewish community in China. There were Jews in Kaifeng, China, from around the 11th century. There's a Jewish community there. Their descendants, who have assimilated, they're no longer Jewish. But approximately a dozen of their descendants within the past 10 years have moved to Israel and converted to Judaism. It's pretty wild, right? Jews probably from Persia went via India to China, settled in Kaifeng, which was the capital at the time, and were accepted in China. There was no anti-Semitism there. They did very well. They assimilated. But lo and behold, I don't know, 1,000 years later, 900 years later, their descendants have returned. Some of them have returned to Judaism, converted to Judaism. This is quite amazing stuff. The Jewish spark maintains itself for a long time. There was a village in Portugal. There's a French documentary about a village in Portugal of crypto-Jews, Jews who converted to Christianity. So in 1497, when the Jews were given the choice of expulsion or conversion in Portugal, 5 years after the expulsion from Spain, because there was a shidduch between a child of King Ferdinand, Queen Isabella, with the child of the Portuguese king. But one of the conditions of the match was we don't want Jews in your country. Right, you can only marry our child. So Portugal said, yeah, no problem. Right, so 1497, they declared either the Jews die, get out, or convert. A lot of Jews converted. There's a village there. They still say Shema. They gather together and say Shema once a week. The conversos, the crypto Jews in this village. That means from 1497 till now.
Remarkable.
That's remarkable, the Jewish spark to maintain itself for so long. There is a friend of mine in Boston who fell in love with a Brazilian woman many years ago and decided that she would convert, and then did research and found out that she was actually Jewish. She was actually all the way back to the expulsion from Spain. So we're a nation that dwells alone. The Torah tells us, Am levadad yishkon, a nation that dwells alone. I don't know if anyone read the book, The Prime Ministers. Excellent, excellent book. Absolutely phenomenal. In the book, The Prime Ministers, there's one section there that talks about Menachem Begin, and there's a fantastic description. Menachem Begin used to have a Torah study group in his home every Shabbat. He used to have a very interesting crowd there. So one week, it was Parshat Bilam, and he had in the Nechama Leibovitz was there, who was a great Bible scholar. My wife was a student of hers, and there was an archaeologist there, and there were a couple of rabbis, and there was some science. It was fat, and they were all discussing this verse. And Menachem Begin said, he says, I just came back recently for the United Nations. He says, when it says Am Levadad Yishkon, a nation that dwells alone, he says, it's so literally true. Mm-hmm. He says, every time I'm there, I'm like totally alone. Right? We're not part, the Israel has not been part of, I mean, recently there's changed, but we were not part of any regional group. We're not in the Middle Eastern regional group, doesn't want to have Israel there because we're not in the Middle East. We don't, you know, the nation that defeated them in five wars doesn't exist as far as they're concerned. So we're not in a, so Amla Valdad Yishkon, the Torah says that we'll call forth reproach, amazement, right, scorn, and despite all that, V'yotam be'eretz aveim lo ma'astim, Hashem says, God says in the Torah, despite the fact that they're in the land of their enemies, I have not despised them, I have not rejected them to completely rid the world of them. They will survive. And again, there are other aspects, also unique aspects of Jewish culture. One of them, I think is amazing, is the study ethic. I mean, the amazing degree to which the Jewish people treasure study, and we treasure learning. Learning of Torah, of course, is the mitzvah of learning Torah, but that has become part and parcel of the, almost like the Jewish psyche and the Jewish nature is the study of Torah. When printing hit the scene in Europe, the Jews like went crazy, seized the opportunity. Wow, because printing, right, printers would print the first complete Talmud printed in Venice in the early 16th century, 1523, right, was actually printed by a Christian who was, of course, he owned the printing press. But he was selling to Jews because Jews just like took to printing like a fish to water. It was an amazing thing. Jews were involved in learning, of course, in the Torah, but in many, many areas. You know, there are three craters on the moon named after Rishonim, named after biblical commentators. One crater is called the Aben Ezra crater. Guess who that's named after? Avraham Ibn Ezra, the great Torah commentator from France and then Spain. There's another crater called the Ralbag Levi crater. That's named after Reb Levi ben Gershon, Gershonides, who was a biblical commentator, philosopher, and an astronomer. And there's another one called the Zagut crater, which is named after Avraham Zakuto, a Jewish astronomer, mathematician, and rabbi. So, you know, amazing. So Jews had a love for learning. The rock star of Spain, in the culture of Spain in the 12th century, the rock star of the poetry circuit was a rabbi, Yehuda Halevi. Yehuda Halevi was the greatest poet. They'd have these poetry slams that have, you know, people come to parties and people would have to create poems about the owner of the house, right, off just off the cuff. Yehuda Halevi, you'd always win, right? So Jews had a love for learning. We just a love for Torah learning, and that's a very, very unique. You know, I think it was Bishop Abelard writes, a student of Abelard writes, that in France in medieval times, he says Jews will spend their last penny on teaching their children how to read, and even their daughters. Very amazing. They'd spend their last penny. Evidently, tuition has not changed, right? So, but they'd spend their last penny on educating their children. That has been part and parcel of Jewish history. We've had many, many unique features. I'm not going to go through all of them, but in terms of Jewish culture, another. Unique feature. I mean, where are Jews? I'm looking at this. I have a little list here of where Jews live. So there are communities with fewer than 100 people. So, for example, the Cayman Islands, that's the, we actually have a student at Yeshiva University from there. There are about 30 Jews there. One of them is at Yeshiva University. He got interested in, I don't know, he knew he was Jewish, and he got onto the internet, and he got onto the YU Torah website. He started listening to classes and he liked it, and so he ended up at YU. It's amazing. Honduras, the Fijian Islands, Guadeloupe, Mozambique, Slovenia, Taiwan, New Caledonia, Namibia, Myanmar, Burma. It's actually, they're actually Responsa. in the writings of the Ben Ishchai, two Jews in Myanmar, in Rangoon, used to be called Rangoon Burma, in Singapore, etc. And of course, the Torah tells us that we will be spread all over the world, and we were. The quality of life of the Jewish people has been something quite exceptional, both in terms, first of all, education and literacy, as we mentioned. The Jewish family life, there's a certain aspect of the family which the Jewish people have really treasured and kept together. I think a lot of that can be attributed to the benefit or to the effect of Shabbos, of actually having Shabbos, where you're actually all together, you're not engaged in other activities, you're with the family. I think that's done a lot. A very relatively low rate of crime and violence, a relatively low rate of, interestingly, and this may have changed, but there's an article here from the British Journal of Addiction. British Journal of Addiction, psychological journal. And the article is entitled The Great Jewish Drink Mystery. Mark Keller, Jews have remarkably low levels of alcoholism. One founder of the modern disease movement, Mark Keller, wrote an article analysing the lack of susceptibility to alcoholism that has characterised Jews. Sociologists Glasner and Berg believe, and this is a fascinating thesis, I don't know if it's provable, but Judaism is not teetotaling. We don't reject alcohol. We drink alcohol. In fact, the first thing that a little Jewish boy will taste, other than his mother's milk, is wine. Right? Gets a little wine. Right? So we have wine at every occasion, Kiddush and Havdalah, and every Yom Tov and every Shabbat, and at a bris and at a wedding, and so on and so forth. That's an amazing thing. So one of these sociologists, he puts it this way. He says, it almost seems as if the more you sanctify something, the less you will abuse it. And that's a very interesting idea, right? We sanctify it. We don't reject it. We don't wallow in it. We sanctify it. And that's an important quality of life. Philanthropy. Study from Johns Hopkins University, which is in Baltimore. It's a branch of Neri Yisrael Yeshiva. So Johns Hopkins University did a study of philanthropy in the United States. And the ethnic group which displays the greatest philanthropic tendencies are Jews. Not just to Jewish causes, but to all look at the state of Israel and its disaster relief help. The best, most efficient and quickest field hospitals set up in Haiti during that terrible hurricane, and in many places around the world have been the Israeli army field hospitals, the mobile medical units have been absolutely amazing. I was a good friend of mine, Harry Rothenberg, a personal injury lawyer, was in a parking lot in Manhattan, and a gentleman was standing next to him, and the gentleman looked at my friend and he said, "Are you Jewish?" And Harry said, "Yeah." I was wearing a yarmulke. He said, my friend says, where are you? Where are you from? The guy said, I'm from Haiti. He said, my daughter's name is Israel. Harry said, why is that? He says, because, he says, her life was saved by the Israeli medical team. And he says, I named her Israel. And he says, there are lots of people in Haiti who owe that. And Israel, what Israel's done in terms of worldwide agriculture with the drip irrigation system, water desalination, the desalination, which of course is saving California right now. These are all. It's an amazing amount of philanthropy from a very tiny war. Unfortunately, a country which is pretty much in an official state of war with many of its neighbors. The impact that we have had on the world in terms of law and morality, in terms of monotheism. Monotheism has had an impact on science as well. There's a fascinating book by James Barbour in which he has an idea that much of science is based. He believes that a lot of the major scientific breakthroughs have come because scientists come from a milieu and a background where they're looking for oneness, for unity, to string things together. Because they come from what he calls a Judeo-Christian background. Because if you come from a classic polytheistic background, multiple gods, then your mind is not going to be tuned in to looking for the thing that strings things together, the theory of everything, the grand unifying theory, the algorithm that links things together. But science is based on that idea. So he actually links modern scientific progress, even though, of course, there are many, many scientists who are atheists or agnostics, but he links it to, at least coming from a monotheistic background, all of the great philosophical topics are there in the Tanakh. All of the great topics of literature are there in the Tanakh, Torah, prophets, and writings. How much of art and how much of literature has actually been based on ideas and on themes which are found in the Torah, in the prophets, and the writings? And of course, as we know, the Jewish contribution to culture in many ways, just to give you an idea of the, this is already a cliche, but the Jewish Nobel Prizes, we've had approximately 160 65 Nobel Prizes awarded to Jews, which is 22% of all Nobel Prizes. When you consider that the Jewish people are about 0.01% of the world's population, that is very impressive. By the way, and it's not just in the United States, 36% of Nobel Prize winners have been Jewish. In the scientific research fields, chemistry, economics, medicine, and physics, Jewish world percentage is 25%. Throughout the world, and in the US, 38%. So we make approximately 0.25% of the world's population. But still, that means 0.25% of the world's population, 25% of Nobel Prizes in sciences, 0.2% of the US population, 25% of the US Nobel Prizes. That's quite something. And of course, the Torah tells us in Bereishis, last week's parsha, it says, "V'nivruchu b'cha kol mishpachos ha'adama." This week's parasha. God says to Abraham that all your children will be a blessing to all the nations of the world. I was once speaking to Senator Sam Brownback from Kansas. So Kansas is four Jews. I mean, he doesn't pander to a Jewish vote in Kansas, that's for sure, right? You know, there's probably a minion in Kansas, but I mean, there's definitely no, I have a student from Topeka, Kansas in my class at Yeshiva University, actually. I was eating with him at a kosher Japanese restaurant, right? And I remember he was very surprised. He said he ordered something, it was a huge portion. And he says, "Japanese restaurants are usually not such large portions." I said, "Senator, it's a kosher Japanese." Jews, right? So I asked him, you know, it's interesting, he's a major supporter of Israel. He is one of the great supporters of the state of Israel. And I said, "Why do you support Israel so much?" And he said, "Well, it's enlightened self-interest." He says, "Purely selfish reasons." I said, "Why is that?" He says, "The Bible says in Genesis 22, God says that I will bless those who bless you." He says, "I believe that the blessings that we have in the United States, of prosperity and so on and so forth, are because we have been a blessing to the Jews. We've supported the state of Israel. Jews have religious freedom here. Jews have freedom here." He says, "I would like to be blessed. So I'm blessing you." Amazing. As simple as that. Incredible. So the land of Israel, and we'll end with the land of Israel, the exile and desolation that Israel had for thousands of years until her children came back, and have now the only country entering the 21st century with a net increase in the total amount of trees, is Israel. The Jewish people come back to the land of Israel. As the Torah says, "Ve'hitivcha v'hir b'cha ma'avosecha," I'll make you, it'll be better and even larger than your fathers had. And yes, the state of Israel, successful economically, militarily, academically, in terms of Torah learning, how much Torah learning there is in the land of Israel, how many publications are published, Kimitzion Teitzei Torah, Udvar Hashem Yerushalayim, how many people have had teachers or rabbis or instructors who have not studied in Israel? Very few. Most of us, wherever we grew up, whether it was Australia or South Africa or New York or etc., right? A lot of your teachers studied in Israel. Right? It's a standard thing. The Torah shall come forth from Zion, and the word of God from Jerusalem. Israel was a state which had, in 1948, approximately 600,000 people. From now 1948 until the mid-50s, Israel absorbed approximately 600,000 people, refugees, mostly penniless refugees. That means a country absorbed 100% of its population when it was a nascent, newborn country. That's incredible. Incredible. But Israel did that. And during that time, with being attacked by the countries around us, having to defend economics, technology, agriculture, in every area, Israel is a technological and amazing powerhouse. And the Torah told us this would happen. We have an ingathering of the exiles, the Jews from all over the world. The apartment building I used to live in Har Nof in Jerusalem. Our downstairs neighbor was from Gibraltar. He was from Gibraltar. In fact, when I was in Sicily, our logistics person is Israeli. Her name was Aya. And I said, "Where are you from, Aya?" She said, "Well, I live in southern Spain, right near Gibraltar." So, of course, I had to play Jewish geography. I say, "Do you know Rafi Marachi from Gibraltar?" She says, "Yes, he's my closest friend." He was my downstairs neighbor in Jerusalem. High scores, high scores. Unbelievable. I've had a tour guide in Naples, Jewish tour guide for our group. So I get a guy in my class in Yeshiva University. I said, his name is Jacopo. Jacopo Pagliari. I said, "Where are you from, Jacopo?" He said, "From Brindisi." I said, "In the Amalfi Coast?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "I was just there. Do you know this tour guide we just had?" He says, "Yeah, he's a good friend of my parents." High scores again. Amazing. But so we have this incredible. The fact is that Jews from all over the world are coming back to Israel. I was in the Isle of Capri. There's a kosher restaurant there. which was established by a Jewish businessman from Panama. I have 50 students from Panama at Yeshiva University who goes there regularly for business, and he wanted to have kosher food, so he started a kosher restaurant. So I'm at the restaurant. I see a family looks faintly familiar, and I say, "Hey." And the guy says, "I'm Erez." I said, "Erez." He's from Neve Daniel, which is a small city in Israel. They were actually when one of my sons was in the army, a lone soldier, they were his host family. So we met them. But they're from Fairlawn, New Jersey. But so Jews from all over the place are back in Israel. So we had someone from Fairlawn in our apartment building. We had someone from Greece, a Jew from Greece. We had a Jew from Gibraltar. We had a family from France who were originally from Morocco. So Morocco to France and then Israel. We had a family from Russia. We had a family from Canada. We had a family from Switzerland. It was in one building, Kibbutz Galiot. The ingathering exiles was in one building in Jerusalem. And we're not the only building like that. So when we look at Jewish history, and we look at the Torah's predictions about it, we look at the unique features of the weird and the wonderful components of Jewish history, I think we have to come to a conclusion that this particle called the Jewish people, there is another force acting on us other than standard sociology and standard historical forces. That force, of course, is God and the Torah. And we have to, as the alien, I would look at this and come to the conclusion that the Jews are indeed weird and different. And, or as Woody Allen said, Jews are just like everyone else, just more so. But we are not like everyone else. Our history is not like everyone else. Our history is really supernatural, even though we live in this natural world. And that supernatural history is leading us to a point of what we call the Geula, the redemption, which is, of course, what we all pray and look forward to. And we see history heading in that direction. We see the Jews gathering back to Israel. We see the establishment of sovereignty in the land of Israel. We see the explosion of Torah study in Israel. We see the explosion of knowledge, of technology, economics, all of this happening in our own lifetimes. It's an amazing thing to see the Jewish history heading to an amazing culmination and an amazing, amazing, weird and wonderful end predicted in the Torah. That's a little bit of an introduction to the subject. The rest is commentary, as Hillel said, go and learn. Thank you for coming. Happy to take questions, heckling, alternate speeches, insults, political statements, endorsements, Twitters. Yes?
I happened to listen to a YouTube guy from Machon Shiloh.
David Bar Chaim.
Yeah, he's
Australian, you know.
Yeah, Yeah.
Yes, okay, well, go ahead, right. Enough said, right? Yeah.
He believes that one day the Minhags are going to come together and there's going to be something called a Minhag Eretz Israel. And even he produced a Siddur and he speaks on YouTube prolifically about
right.
it.
Yes.
And he said part of it has to do with, you know, breaking down the Gullis mentality and mm-hmm. that, you know, since the ingathering of the exiles in Israel. Do you see that as a future, that there will be this Minhag Eretz Yisrael, and what he's trying to promote will catch on?
I hope so. I don't know it will happen. I mean, I think it is heading a little bit towards that, but I certainly hope so, but I can't really, you know, as it's the World Series is happening now, so to quote a great baseball player, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. So,
I heard a while back that when the Israeli Jewish population is the majority of Jews in the world, there'll be some change to halacha. Can you enlighten us on that?
Well, yeah. Well, halacha won't change, but halacha has a certain criteria. Right, yeah, correct. The halacha says that there are certain laws, agricultural laws pertaining to the land of Israel, which are dependent on on the Jews coming to Israel. So the Gemara says, Bias Kulchem, means you're all there. So now generally in halacha, when we say all, what we mean is the majority. So when the majority of the Jews are in Israel, certain laws, agricultural laws like Truma, Masa, etc., will actually become not only, now they're rabbinically obligatory. A lot of them will become biblically obligatory, Do'oraisa, when the majority of Jews are in Israel, which I think they predict is going to happen within 10, 15 years or something like that. I don't know what the predictions are, but it seems likely that... So that's what will happen. That would mean that we'd have to be starting... there are certain restrictions and certain stringencies that would apply to a biblical law that do not apply to rabbinic law, which would come into play in that situation. But yeah, it'll probably happen within 15, 20 years.
Hmm? Your will and property. And
that type of thing, yeah. Yeah. Well, that might... Some things require, Beis HaMikdash and Sanhedrin, but certainly a lot of the things would kick in biblically. Right. Right now, if you go to Costco and you buy fruit and vegetable, a lot of the stuff comes from Israel. Right? So you have to take Truma and Maaser. You have to take tithes from that, right, if it comes from Israel. That's a rabbinic obligation nowadays. But should the majority of the Jews be in Israel... Of course, we won't be buying in Costco in New Jersey anymore. But at that point, but yes, that will become a Doraisa, biblical. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
May I ask, because I'm not biblically knowledgeable, may I ask a current events question?
Sure.
Please? With this ingathering of Jews from all around the world and growing proportionally in one location, in a nuclear age, do you feel that provides a greater risk to have everyone in
Yeah, it's a good question. It's a good question. It does. But that's on the one hand. On the other hand, we do have a certain. We believe that ultimately, Lev Malachim Biyad Hashem, the heart of kings is in the hand of God, and great events of the world, major events, are not things that happen arbitrarily. And are not totally under the control. The great events of history, right, are under what we call hashkacha pratit, meaning God's divine providence. So I don't worry about that. In other words, I take whatever precautions I have to take. In general, we buy insurance and so on and so forth. But in general, worrying about the great events of world-shattering major historical events, that's ultimately in the hands of God. We pray and we trust in God. And so as far as that's concerned, I'm not so worried about that. But it's it is logically speaking, you're right. It's a good question. But it's not totally a matter of logic here. There's a certain level of relationship we have with God. He loves us. We're His children. We love Him, and He is ultimately in control of the world, right? not Kim Jong Un or whatever his name is, right? Yeah, right, etc. Okay, all right. We'll stop here. Oh, one more question. Yeah.
You mentioned seven books.
Oh, I was just saying that Vayehi ben Soa is like a book in itself. So that means Bamidbar is really one book before then, the book of Vayehi ben Soa, and the book after that. So then that Bamidbar becomes three books. So really, no one really calls it seven books. I was just doing that for effect. But the fact is, the Gemara does actually call those two sentences, Vayhi ben Sarah, etc., as a book of the Torah. So, you know, that. Okay. All right, thank you very much, and I'd like to thank the hosts for hosting. And thank you.
Very grateful, Rabbi Becher, and very, very incredible, very moving. I would like to mention that Rabbi Becher has available a very popular, very insightful book about Judaism. If you want to get some real, you know, insight and an overview of Judaism in depth, Gateway to Judaism, Rabbi Becher has some copies with him, and you can see him about that. I would like to acknowledge the presence of a very, very special individual. Rebbetzin Leibowitz is with us tonight. Rebbetzin Leibowitz was the Rebbetzin of my Rebbe, Rabbi Altanach Leibowitz. He was my Rebbe, my mentor, my life mentor, for close to 40 years. And we are honored that the Rebbetzin joined us tonight. We're very, very pleased that you are here.
My privilege.
In 5 minutes...